And now, News Talk 1360 WCHL presents Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show about getting educated, getting hired, and getting inspired. Hosted by the staggeringly positive Kristen Heemstra, an experienced human resources manager and college admissions consultant. And now, here's Kristen on WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra. Welcome to the Art of Potential show. Oh, so much fun we have for you today because we are going to be talking about everybody's favorite subject. Tips for the SAT. I know it's been keeping you up at night, but we have the world's greatest expert on this. Welcome, Debbie Steer.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, I am so glad to have you because I have yet to find anyone who is as passionate or as knowledgeable about this test as you are.
Oh, well, you haven't. There's a whole little secret tribe of us, and you know, there's not many. We're niche, but there's more than one of me. I would say I'm maybe a party of 10 at this point.
So you're telling me that there are 10 adults running around trying to take the SAT to get a perfect score?
Well, no. Okay, I didn't say that. I don't know anybody else who's doing that. But that love the SAT like I do. And I would have to, I guess, qualify by saying the other, and maybe I would put it even in the 15 range, okay. The other people I know are tutors. I guess if that's what you love to do, that's what you do. I guess you also have to have that gift for teaching, which I don't think yes. I necessarily have. In fact, I'm pretty sure I don't.
You can do it, but not necessarily teach it.
Right, exactly. Okay. But anyway, they love it. There are people out there that love it like I do. And I would say I got my son to the point of, you know, liking it like a game he wants to beat, which is, you know, pretty darn good.
It's great, especially for this particular generation, because they really are game-oriented.
Yes, and that is how he sees it. There was a moment where that sort of clicked in, and he saw it as, like, something he wanted to beat. And, you know, I've been much more methodical about it for him than I was for myself. And, you know, he's in a range where, you know, if you're in that middle range, it's easier to see progress faster. But he's sort of, you know, at the high 600, low 700 range, one or two questions really throws you off. And I made a chart of all of this. I've been making him take full-time tests every weekend. And then I made a chart of his progress. And he's eking it up there point by point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's what it takes. I mean, it is not a short-term thing for most people.
Okay.
I would say there are exceptions.
Well, so let's go ahead and figure out the best way for people to do well on the SAT. Because,
right.
Like I was saying, first of all, why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself so that people know why you are the expert?
Okay. I did abysmally on the SAT in high school. In fact, it was 1982 when I took it, and there were four or five schools that were SAT optional at the time. And if you went to one of these schools, it was Bard, Sarah Lawrence, Hampshire, and Bennington, and Bowdoin. If you went to one of those schools, that pretty much meant you got bad SAT scores. You were creative. And so I went to one of those schools. I went to Bennington. And I always assumed at the time that, well, I didn't try, and so that's why I did badly. I sort of had it in my head. I was bad at math. I was creative. And I kind of wanted a redo, especially when my son was starting to go through it or approaching the process. I thought, well, what would happen if I tried? Maybe I could do it. In fact, I was sure I could do it. And so what I decided to do was to take the test every time it was offered in 2011, which is seven times. It's offered internationally seven times a year, unless you get those Sundays. But and I took it every time it was offered in official settings, in different settings, and I tried to see what it would take to get a perfect score. And I studied with different methods. You know, I attempted to, you know, to use a method a month. I was not as methodical about it as...
Did they blur?
They blurred because what would happen was, you know, I would start a program. Like my second month, I was going to do the Khan Academy, that free, everyone loves it, online video,
yep.
You know, with the exercises. But in two or three days, I was spending all of my time on navigation. Now, maybe he's fixed it since then. I know they've had a huge influx of money, and they've really updated the site. But at the time I was trying to use it, I was spending 90% of my time on navigational issues. And I was like, okay, there's no way I'm going to get where I'm going doing this. And so I switched. But I also want to say, now that I'm at the end of this process, that test prep hopping is not a way to get a good score. That you should pick a plan that's a good plan and stick with that plan till the end. Commit to your plan and then take that plan to the end.
Okay, so let me just make sure I heard you correctly. Test prep hopping is not the way to go.
Yeah, which is what I did. I was going to try Kaplan 1 month and, you know, Khan Academy another month and Grokket another month. I was going to try 12 different methods of test prep, thinking the more tips and tricks I have, the better. That's a bad idea.
Okay, so your recommendation is to pick one and stick with it, and you're good to go.
Pick a good one. You can't pick anyone.
Okay, so, well, let's hear it, because you've been through them all. What are the good ones?
I mean, I would really have to say that a College Board-based program, I would be very hesitant to use anything. It depends on the kid. It depends on whether they, you know, learn better one-on-one or in a class. They can learn in a classroom setting or, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a kid who is self-directed with a great educational foundation, they could do the program on their own, the Blue Book and the online course. But really, I think it has to be based in official material. And anything that's not based in official College Board material, I don't think it's really worth the time.
Well, and it's not just time. Those programs that are not officially based on College Board material are... Let me just kind of cut through this. Are you talking about programs like the big name programs that are out there, the reviews and the Kaplan's and the Princeton's?
I am. I mean, all of it, really. I mean, you know, for the most part, the indies, there's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, smaller companies and sites. And what they do is use sort of as the base College Board material and then maybe supplement it with some of their own stuff that's really just to teach you, I wouldn't say tricks, but strategies, you know, back solving or plugging in, that sort of thing. But there's really no way, you know, for another company to replicate, say, the critical reading. It's just not possible. It's such a precise and subtle science. And, you know, the other companies do, you know, worse or better jobs at it, but nobody's going to do it as well as the College Board. So you might as well use their material or a program that uses their material, or a tutor that uses their material.
Okay. Well, I do have to say it is a huge industry out there. And also, I just want to say it is interesting that you're going to pay a company to prep you to take their test.
I find that very interesting, too. And there's a whole movement of people who have problems with that. And I understand that. But I guess, you know,
it is what it is.
It is what it is. So I'm playing the game. And, you know, believe me, I've had my whole, you know, I've had issues about that, but it is what it is, so I've got to play the game by the rules.
Right, and we all do. I mean, and just for people who are listening, there are a few different baseline tests that are used for college admission. The SAT is one of them, and the ACT is the other big one. And the ACT is different from the SAT in that it's more content-driven because you're tested on different subject areas, where the SAT is really going to hammer on the math and the reading and the writing aspects.
And I think they, you know, my understanding, and I'm saying this as somebody who has not spent very much time with the ACT, but my understanding is for the ACT, you have to go faster, if you can believe that.
Okay.
But it's not as sort of subtle and sophisticated.
Right.
So they'll say, you know, in the critical reading passage, it'll be something you go to the passage and pick out. The College Board would ask you to infer, you know, read between the lines. And back to what you said about the College Board making you pay for a test that they're, you know, to prepare for a test that they're giving you. They do have a lot of free materials. I'll say that. You know, you can get pretty far, not really far, but pretty far with the free materials. And the Blue Book you can get on Amazon for under $13. So really, if you're self-directed and that sort of thing, you can do it pretty inexpensively.
Which is huge, because the test itself, how much are you paying for the test itself?
Oh, I can't remember, but it's about $50, maybe $45, something like that.
So that's a chunk of change.
They do have fee waivers.
We do. We have fee waivers. But, fee waivers are great if you're definitely below the poverty line. It's the people who are kind of in the middle. It's just not, if you don't have a lot of money to throw at the thing, it is nice to know that you can still prep well for it. Because I do think it feels kind of like you watch everyone going through these sophisticated programs and
Okay. Okay. So if you are a self-directed person who doesn't have a lot of money, definitely the College Board Blue Book that's under $13 and their, free stuff that they, tools that they offer online, that will get you pretty far. Okay. But if you do need help, and by the way, the internet has solutions to every single problem. If you Google, the problem, type it into Google, you will come up with so many solutions, it'll blow your mind. And if by chance you don't understand the solutions, type it into College Confidential and they will swoop like a swarm on your question anytime, 24/7, and three or four people will answer it in different ways and show you how to solve it.
Oh, that's awesome.
There is so much free help out there. It's amazing. I was going to say something and I lost my... Oh, I know what I was going to say. I did... The very last test prep method I did was a company called Advantage, and they're, I don't know about the most high-end, but certainly one of the most, if not the most, and very well-respected, and they also have a foundation for people who don't have money, Advantage Foundation. And I said to the founder, well, what about everybody else in the middle, that vast middle? So if you're rich, you can have Advantage, and if you're poor, you can have Advantage. Mm-hmm. And he said, like I was growing up, and I said, well, I guess. And he said, Debbie, in 25 years of doing this, I have never turned anybody away. He said, if somebody wants to be tutored and they come and they can show me that they need some sort of financial support, I've never in 25 years turned anybody away. And that stuck with me because I bet you anything, if you went to, the best tutor in your area and were able to show that you were an enthusiastic participant who... is in need, I bet you anything they would have a sliding scale.
Well, it's certainly worth looking into because you have nothing to lose. We're going to take a quick break because we have so much to cover in such a short time. So you are listening to The Art of Potential Show. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Debbie Steele.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is the Art of Potential show, and I'm Kristen Heemstra. I'm talking with Debbie Steer, who is the queen of the SAT. So, Debbie, my question to you, what is the best way to study for this thing?
All right. If I were to do it all over again, knowing what I know now, and by the way, I was able to do that with my son.
Yay!
I did it a year in advance of him. It occurred to me afterwards, I took my first SAT, my first grown-up SAT, in January of 2011. He took his in January of 2012, so it was kind of a year ahead of him. What I would do is this. I would be absolutely methodical. I was not methodical at all. I was all over the map. I would take a baseline test, and they offer it free on the College Board's website, a full SAT, and I would take it timed. I would buy the Blue Book, $13, actually just a little under that from Amazon, and I would see what my score was, and then I would read that whole beginning section of the Blue Book, the part that nobody reads. It's a couple hundred pages before you get to those 10 tests, and I would spend a good long time carefully savoring everything they say, because it is the test makers telling you what they're testing and how to do it. And nobody reads it. I skimmed it. Mm-hmm. There's so much good information in there, I can't believe it. And then when I was done with that, and that could take you weeks or even months, depending on, how much you're willing to devote per week. But if you're a normal student, I would think, a couple months worth of carefully. There's a lot of exercises in there. And I would do all the stuff on their site that's free. And then with those 10 tests in the Blue Book, I would do every single one timed, full, beginning to end, and then spend a week or two going over your answers deeply. And that would include highlighting every single vocab word that you don't know, even on the questions that you got right, making a flashcard, studying them a lot, seeing if you can see any patterns to your errors. Like, by the way, the College Board offers solutions on their site, too. There's a code in the book. Nobody knows about this. It's like on page 11, it'll say, go and type in this, the third word of this sentence, and you come up with their solutions.
No way.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't actually, to be quite honest with you, they were not the most helpful to me.
Okay.
Because you have to have a certain base level of knowledge. You know, they'll talk about dangling participles and antecedent pronouns and all sorts of things that I didn't know what they were. So unless you know what they are,
right,
they weren't that helpful. But anyway, I would spend, you know, depending on how much time you're going to give to this, at least a week, maybe even 2 weeks, to really deeply go over your answers. And then I would do another full-time test, because what you need those 10 tests for, it's a test of endurance and performance as much as it is of the knowledge. So you need to save those 10 tests for endurance purposes as much as it is to learn the material. In other words, learn your material elsewhere. And
okay.
If I added a little bit of, you know, a little shake of something else, there are some books out there, if you could afford something else, or free websites, Pwn the SAT, the Ultimate SAT Verbal, which I believe now is called the Critical Reader, and they show you the strategies, because, you know, they're shortcuts, and the College Board pretty much does not show you the shortcuts. They'll show you how to do the problem the proper way, but there are some shortcuts, especially with the math.
Okay, so it almost sounds like you're talking about training for a marathon.
Yes, that's what it is. That's exactly what it felt like. It felt like I needed, you know, the road runner's, you know, map of
yes.
how to train. When I did do a marathon, and I went on the Road Runner Club, and I printed out their beginner marathon schedule, and I followed it almost to a T. And this I did without a roadmap. And I did it all wrong. And if I were to do it again, I would do it just the way I just told you. And that's what I've done with my son.
Okay. So you learn the material somewhere else. You're picking up the material, if not from those 10 tests. Where are you supposed
to? Well, the beginning part of the blue book. And there's a couple hundred pages in there.
Okay.
That's serious, good material. Because not only do they teach you the strategies, but they also have practice stuff.
Okay.
And then online on their site, they have free free tools. Now, it's not infinite, but there's a couple hundred questions probably you could go through.
Mm.
And it's not, to me, it wasn't the most user-friendly, but I think that, you know, kids who are, you know, raised on the internet more or are mm-hmm. more used to working online, like, I need a pencil and paper to understand. I can't process it when it's on a screen. And so if you're like me, then maybe that College Board online thing won't work, but the beginning of the blue book certainly will. Nobody looks at that. It's like the forward or the, you know, it's the beginning part, but there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Okay.
Yeah, that could take you a good long while. Oh, and then the vocab. I mean, you can do so much better on the reading section just by knowing a lot of vocabulary, and those direct hits books are excellent.
Okay, they're called direct hit books?
Direct hits, yep. They have the most frequent vocabulary, the core vocabulary, and the most difficult vocabulary. What they do is they put it in context for high schoolers, you know, pop culture. So it'll refer to, you know, the Hunger Games, and it'll use the vocabulary in everyday context. Lady Gaga, da-da-da-da-da, and they use SAT vocabulary. And it really does help them. At least it helped my son, and I read about it everywhere.
Yeah, that's a great tip. Because we have, like, in the school that I see students at, students will come in and say, yeah, I have to learn 2,000 vocabulary words this week.
Right.
You're like, you're kidding me. And they're like, no, it's like, you know, a couple hundred a day. And then
right.
da, 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 da. You're like, oh, my gosh.
I just don't think that's possible. I really don't.
Right.
I need to write things down to remember them, so I really found it effective to go through every single SAT, and I went through the critical reading passages, I went through the, and I do it for my son when he's done with the practice test, because if I leave it to him, he'll highlight like 3 or 4 words. but if I go through and I highlight all the words, I say, tell me the definition. If you can't tell me the definition and use it in a sentence, and by the way, they love to do the third or fourth definition of a word. So they take a word that you know and use it in an unfamiliar way.
Uh-huh.
You know, so that's a little tricky. So yeah, I would highlight 30 words a test, and he might, on his own, only highlight 10.
And it was part of it because he knew the word in a different
context?
No,
he thinks he knows more than he does, which
right.
I think is a common thing,
very
not
common.
Only for
very
you know, kids, but for people. I mean, I know that happened to me. I kept thinking I knew more than I did. Every time I said, I feel like I know it, that was a big sign that I should go back to the book. Seriously.
Okay.
Actually, there's a phenomenon. Daniel Willingham, he's a neuroscientist. I think he's at UVA. And he said that feeling of familiarity is, it is, it's human nature, and that most people, I think they know only 60% of what they actually know, and that you should always study at least 20% more than you think you should. So if you want to get an A, and you're studying for an A, and you think you're there, or if you want to get a 700, whatever it is, study 20% more than you think you should.
That's a great way to look at it. But, I mean, just from giving us the time frames you're talking about, mm-hmm. 20% more, you're talking months more.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't think there's a way. I mean, it depends. Do you want to go up 20 or 30 points, or do you want to, like, do you want to score like a top score, or do you want to score like a 500-600? If you want to score 500-600, I don't think, you know, I mean, depends on who you are and your level and everything like that, but it's not going to take you a year. But if you want a top score, you know, in the sevens for everything across the board, and you're a normal person, you're not an outlier who's, you know, brilliant.
Right.
With this, you know, a year. I think that's a fair amount of time to do it in a gentle way where it will stick.
Well,
and it will build on itself.
Now, the thing to keep in mind is that you're talking about a year's worth of preparation during a time
mm-hmm.
when most students are hitting the most rigorous part of their academic careers.
Yep.
Because the best time to take the SAT, or the most common time, is in the junior year. Now, one thing that I am familiar with, and I believe it's still the case, is that the SAT math tops out at Algebra 2.
Right.
And so for some people, just hitting that, you know, and a lot of folks, the way the school system is set up now, Algebra 2 is completed often by the end of the sophomore year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. This is Kristen Heemstra, and you are listening to the Art of Potential show.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Debbie Sear. We're talking about the SAT and tips for taking it. So let's talk about math. What's your take on math, Debbie?
All right. Well, the math section is the section that, A, I loved the most, B, I spent the most time on. In fact, I would say I spent 90% of my time on, and C, I improved the least. In fact, I ended up with almost the same score that I had in high school.
No way.
Yes, and I loved it. It made no sense. I'm sure I know much more math. my son, the math, you know, came much more easily to him. He did much better than me. Good for him, thank goodness. But here's the thing about the math. You have to know all the math basics. I mean, really know them. And things you probably don't even remember that you have to know that go back to elementary school, like an integer. Is zero an integer? Is zero positive? Is it negative? Things like that, because they'll put something in there. And if you don't know the nuances like that, and who remembers that by the time you're, you know, in your 40s, but no, you know, when you're 16 or 17, you might not remember. Is zero an integer? Is negative four an integer? Is, you know, 0.25 an integer? But by the way, in the beginning of the blue book, I feel like I'm selling the blue book or something, they do go over all that stuff. But it would behoove you, I think, to refresh yourself on that, you know, beginning stuff. Just a refresher, depending on, you know, how much, you know, how advanced you are. You know, and then all the stuff certainly that you've been taught all the way through Algebra 2, just like you said. And then after you're really comfortable with all that stuff, which is all in the beginning of that blue book, then I would work on the strategy part of it, because there are shortcuts and there are patterns. So, for instance, you know, they do a lot of variable questions. And everyone who knows the SAT knows you plug in real numbers. That's the way to do those. But I don't think the College Board would tell you to plug in numbers. They might do that one. Or sometimes the fastest way to the answer is to take one of the answers and to plug it back into the problem, back solving it. They're not going to show you those kind of shortcuts. Or sometimes to eyeball it. There are a few times when it's okay to eyeball it. And they do
the same thing. What does it mean to eyeball something?
You know, sometimes there are ways to get to the guesstimating. You know, there are certain questions that you can look at, and the fastest way to that answer is to just is to eyeball it.
Okay.
And then there's also strategies, and I did not do this till the bitter end. I can't believe it, but it's just so basic. But so, you know, in the math, it becomes sequentially harder. And so better to get 1 through 15 right than to gallop your way to try to get to number 20, which was what I did. I was always trying to finish, which was silly, because then I would make stupid errors on number 8 or something.
Right.
And I knew number 8, but you have to read every single word, and they could trip you up with one word. And then, of course, in the grid in section, it's 1 through 8, and then it starts over at 9 through 18. It gets easy again at 9. And so the strategy there would be to do 1 through 6, and then skip 7 and 8, do 9 through 16, and then you've got 7 and 8, 17 and 18, and you look at those four with the rest of your time and decide, okay, which one of these hard ones should I do first? I didn't do that until my last test. And that's the way all, because they're all worth 1 point. You might as well get your 1 point on the easy ones and get those right. Then, so those sort of things, that's how I would attack the math. And then you'll start to see patterns of, oh, you know, I'm always getting these function problems wrong. Well, the College Board will help you do function problems, or you can find function problems a lot of different places. There's a blog called Eric the Red. He's got lots of function problems that are just like the SAT ones.
Okay.
So anyway, that's how I would do the math. I found that, you know, I use the calculator for everything. I mean, I can't tell you how many mistakes I made by, you know, doing a simple math calculation in my head wrong under the pressure, you know? It was like, oh my God. Here's another funny tip that people don't think of with the math. And, you know, I went and helped some young girl the other day, and she took it at one of the places that I took it where they had those little deskettes, you know, where they, I call them the pork chop.
The pork chop, I saw that in your blog.
Yeah. And when you have to get to a math section and you've got your calculator and you can't fit it on your desk, the juggle and the dropping of the calculators, it's so distracting, and it's very hard to take the math section on one of those. So I would even call ahead and make sure that you get a proper desk. I'm serious. I did that with my son, and I did it on my final test. I said, you know, I did it both times. I said, I know I'm sounding, but if you just make sure, because I think that desk technically fits within what they're allowed to do, but I'm telling you, it's not a convenient space, especially for the math.
When you've got so many props and things going on.
Yes, you've got the pencils and the answer book and the test book and the calculator, and then everyone starts dropping their calculators, and so that's distracting too.
Okay.
So I think it's worth asking.
Well, you were saying that each problem is worth 1 point. And I was thinking in the scoring section, I mean, you don't do 800 problems in math.
Right.
So
I think you do, I think it's approximately 60. I don't have it in front of me, but it's give or take 60 around there, maybe 58, 54. I can't remember. There's the most questions, I want to say, in the reading, and then the math and the writing have less. I should know this, but.
Well, so if you do well on a math problem, it seems like, you know, if you were to take it multiple times and the first time you missed that problem and the second time you got that problem correct, it seems like your score would be bumped then 10 to 20 points.
It's something like that, yeah. It depends on, you know, because it's graded on a curve, too. So it depends on how hard the test is. The test my son took in January apparently was a hard curve. So you miss one problem and you bump down a lot of points.
So explain the curve, because I don't know exactly what that means.
Oh, some of the tests are harder than other tests, And so...
I'm sure I took the hard test all the time.
Right. But see, the thing is, then it would be an easier curve.
Right.
And so, you know, that's how they balance that out. And it's based on, you know, I guess how many people are getting them right or wrong. Or actually, strangely enough, and this is very sophisticated math that is way beyond me, but it's actually based on last year's testers. I don't understand it. Eric the Red has a very in-depth explanation of it that went way over my head. All I know is there's a curve. Sometimes the, you know, the questions are worth more than others depending on what the curve is.
Which is, to your point or Eric the Red's point, I know each time you take an SAT, isn't there always a, like, one of the tests they're trying to norm at that time as part of the exam?
Yeah, there's a section. Yep. Unless you have the accommodations with the time and a half, and they only give you the 9 sections. But if you're, you know, in the regular test, there's 10 sections and only 9 of them are real, and you don't know which one is the experimental section. So you're always doing an extra section, you know, as work for them, and you don't know which one it is. And you can go to College Confidential afterwards. You can sort of figure it out because it's the weirdest thing. By the time you get home, and some of the tests I took were maybe 15 minutes away, those message boards on College Confidential were always hopping with people talking about it. I was like, how did they get home so fast?
Right.
And so you can sort of figure out, oh, I got this test, but nobody else did. That must be the experimental. But, you know, I was never able to definitively figure it out.
Right.
But sometimes there were clues. Like one time, in fact, it was my last test, there was a question with a food label. And I was pretty sure I got that right. And people were up in arms, especially the international people who took the test, because they didn't know how to read an American food label. Well, it turned out that section was experimental, and I guess that should have been my clue.
Right.
But anyway, I would say more often than not, I was not able to, or I didn't really parse it enough to figure out deeply which section was experimental. I mean, you always know, if you've taken the test enough times, oh, I had an extra math section. One of my math sections was experimental. Although, by the way, I got 6 out of 7 experimental reading sections.
Huh, good for you.
Experimental math. Although I found the reading the most grueling, but I did well on that, despite it being hard.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much for sharing your tips.
Anytime.
This is Kristen Heemstra, and you are listening to the Art of Potential Show.
You're listening to Art of Potential on WCHL. Once again, here's your host, Kristen Heemstra.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra. I'm talking with Debbie Steer about everyone's favorite subject, the SAT. So talk to me about reading. You said that was the most grueling for you. And can you just share a little bit about your background so listeners know?
Yeah. Okay. So I graduated from college, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had a liberal arts background, and my mom said, well, what do you like to do? And I said, I like to read. And she said, well, why don't you go into book publishing? And that never occurred to me. So I spent 23 years working in book publishing, and I did a little bit of almost everything, from editing to marketing to PR. But pretty much anywhere you are in a publishing house, you have to gorge on books. So you think you have to read a lot in college? You have to read like 100 times more than that in book publishing.
Yes.
And so it was, you know, I learned, I always say it was like I Love Lucy at the Chocolate Factory, where, I don't know if anybody's seen that, where there's, you know, first the chocolates are coming at normal speed, then they're stuffing them in their mouths and their aprons and everything. And that's what it was like. And I learned how to read, how to mass consume.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not good for SAT reading. Like, I can read 3 or 4 books a day. That does not help you on the SAT. You'd be better off with a dash of, say, you know, autism, because you have to pick through blades of grass and every single word. It's not the kind of eye-gulping reading that I did. And so I kind of had to relearn, you know, how to do that. What I had going for me was that I liked it. And I think I always say, if you love it, it will love you back. It helps to love it. It really does. So even if you're just faking it, try.
Right.
Vocab, I mean, you can get, my son for a long time said, I'd rather have a lower score than have to study vocab. I was like, are you crazy? And I would show him at school, I go, if you didn't miss the vocab, you'd be turning some heads with your score. Right. He's like, I don't care. And then we went and looked at colleges, and he saw, this is what the kids who get the good scores get. And I was like, and he came back, and he started studying vocab. And
college visits, I just want to do a plug for those. They are so important if you have particularly a child who is less than motivated and more than capable.
We had so much fun. It was just wonder and joy. I mean, it's the pinnacle, I think, of the parenting experience. It achieves every hallmark expectation in a way that most of the others don't. I mean, it was just, you know, we went to each city, and it was like, is this my city?
Right.
And is this it? Is this my school? And it's really interesting. You can get a vibe from the campus, whether, you know, and it has motivated him. It really has.
And I just want to make one more comment on that. The fit is so important with the school, and a fit is a heart thing. It is not a head thing. And you can tell when you get into the right fit, it's like, all right, this is it.
And it's interesting because in his head, and I'm not going to name which school this was, he had a school in his mind that was going to be his safety school, and that's why he wasn't going to have to study vocab.
Right.
That school was going to let him in, and they were going to give him scholarship money because they were going to want him so badly.
Absolutely.
And then we went and took a tour of that school, and he looked so – it was after – you know, it was maybe our fifth or sixth school, and it was the last one, and he looked so down. It was so depressing. It was this huge, very impersonal school, and he's a kid who needs – a little more warmth and nurturing than that. And I'm sure that school is perfectly fine for a lot of kids, but for him, it was not a fit.
Mm-hmm.
Versus we went to, you know, he goes to a Jesuit school, and he felt very comfortable at all the Jesuit schools. It was interesting. So, I mean, it was just a coincidence, or maybe not. I think they have maybe a tighter net there.
Yeah, I think so. Just from the students that I've seen who have gone to Jesuit schools, there's definitely
just a little bit more support.
Mm-hmm.
So the reading, you know, the vocab alone will help you a lot. I think that, you know, you have to be a good reader, and you have to get that sort of perfect distance from the passage. I mean, as I said, I was an eye gulper. That's not going to help you. You have to. But also then I started sort of getting too close to it, and then I couldn't finish because I was going too slowly. So you have to sort of get the speed right and the pacing right, and that takes lots of practice. And then, you know, the questions and answers, you know, here is a big thing that I didn't realize until the very end. I was in love with the passages, most, not all. The science passages didn't thrill me, but, you know, I found all my favorite authors in there, Bill Bryson and Oliver Sacks and Temple Grandin. I mean, it was like hunting for my favorite authors. I'd read a lot of the books. It was so exciting to me. I never considered the fact that the writers of the questions and answers are people. They're not automated. I never thought about them or cared about them, and I think I should have, because they're speaking a language, and I think it would help to think of them like the boss and, you know, consider them. Because once I did that, this was the very, very end, and I went back, and I, you know, you can start to see patterns in the way they ask things. And so I think it would, you know, be beneficial to look at the question and answer writers as well as the passage writer.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they're speaking different languages, but the, you know, the standardized, it's very particular and sophisticated and subtle.
But yeah, are you suggesting they have an agenda almost as to what they're asking?
Well, they're testing certain things. They're testing. They're seeing, you know, what level you can think at.
Mm-hmm.
And you really do have to, I always said, tune into their frequency. And I always said that I was the round peg for the square hole. It was not easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could very easily eliminate three choices. But there were many times when I could get it down to two choices, and I felt like I could argue my choice as much as their choice. Well, that's like arguing with the boss at the job interview. You don't do that. So it would be better to get into the boss's head and think, what does the boss want? That's how I would look at that.
All right.
Yeah. And I would cross out the wrong answers, like the whole line. Get it out of your visual line.
That's a great idea. Yeah, it does, because then you, like, mentally don't consider it anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As soon as you realize it's wrong, cross it out.
All right. We have just a few minutes left. I would love to hear your advice on the writing section.
Okay. All right. So the writing is one third of the score is from your essay, which is the first section of the test, and then two thirds are the grammar questions. For the grammar questions, you have to get Erica Meltzer's book. It's maybe $25. It's worth every single penny, and read everything she has in her blog, because I say it's hard to mimic the College Board. She mimics the College Board perfectly. It's scary. and after I did her book, I got an 800. And I never knew. Before I did her book, I did the whole thing by ear, and my ear is pretty good. I never, nobody ever taught me grammar. The only thing anybody ever said was, a comma happens when you feel a pause, and that's not even right. That's not accurate.
That's
it's the only piece
right?
of grammar I was ever taught. So I didn't know what dangling modifiers or comma splices or, you know, idiomatic expressions. I didn't know any of that. Her book teaches you all of that. And so the grammar's actually, once you figure it out, it's not hard. I mean, most of them are subject-verb agreements or dangling modifiers. I mean, you know, they really, it's not that many rules. I want to say it's kind of the easiest section. And by the way, it's the section the schools count the least. I can't tell you how many times I heard we don't use the writing section.
Yeah.
So anyway,
that's
down those
California.
Grammatical things. Practice, practice, practice. It's really not that hard. Once you start to get into it, you'll see, oh, there's like 10 things you have to know. The essay. Now, the essay, you know, I had the highest score I ever got was a 10 out of 12. But by the way, you can get an 800 with a 10 as long as you don't make any grammar mistakes. And I would say there's 50 or 60 grammatical questions. So I got a 10. You know, here it is. They give you this very esoteric prompt. I would go in there with three or four things that you can fit into almost any answer. And I would say, be safe than sorry. Have a few literary examples. Personal examples are okay, too. The first thing you do is answer the question. So if they say, you know, is it better to be structured or to be creative? Choose a side. It's better to be structured. And then make your case. Pretend you're on the debate team. And every single paragraph, go back and relate it back to that prompt.
Okay.
You know, sprinkle in some of the SAT vocab. That helps vary your sentence structure. If you have time in the end, in the last paragraph, do a counterexample. You know, while some might say that creativity is better than structure, you can see illustrated through the examples of blah-bitty-blah and blah-bitty-blah that is not the case. And therefore, you know, structure is better than creativity, period. And fill up both pages of the thing. Don't go out of the lines. Write as neatly as you can. Don't make any grammatical mistakes. It's hard. And practice. Oh, here's the thing. I mean, to write an essay in 25 minutes, just like I said, is very hard. Very, very hard. And the timing, I mean, I was terrified that I was not going to be able to think of an example, which was, you know, definitely within the realm of possibility. And the more I practiced, the easier it got, definitely. And I saw the essays that got the great scores, and they were, I mean, I kind of call it standardized writing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the picture in the picture frame at Bed Bath & Beyond. It's, you know, it's very formulaic. It's not great writing, but nonetheless, it's not that hard to get a 10. If you do what I just said, you'll get a 10.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. Where can people find you?
Oh, perfectschoolproject.com.
All right.
Sign up for my email if you want. I'll start updating it soon. As soon as I'm done with it, I'm writing a book. I'll be done in like a month, and then I'm going to start the daily blog post again. But there's all sorts of tips, you know, for test day and
everything.
Preparation and what I think about this and that.
I will have a link on it to the Art of Potential website, so you can find it there, artofpotential.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You have just listened to the Art of Potential show with Kristen Heemstra.